Well, thank you, everybody, for coming in from the sunshine to hear what I have to say. And I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the people who have organized this workshop. It's not far from over, but it has really been a very, very nice workshop, and I think very successful. The original title, which I had in mind, was more or less this one: When 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 2, that is to say, to describe to you various activities that have been going on with ultra-cold two-species experiments at Rochester. But somehow or other, I didn't manage to get that title straight through and into the machinery, so I guess my title is more correctly Two-Species DEC Activities. I was one-upped on that already. The title that I really should have picked was the Two Boson Approximation, but I didn't think of that one. The people who have contributed to this most directly have been Han Pu, who's worked extensively on the theoretical work that will fill a majority of my talk, Jim Schaefer, Vitek Lupchak, who have done a lot of experiments in sodium and cesium mixtures and magneto-optical traps, and then Renato Einesman, Paul Rudy, York Young, who have worked on sodium rubidium experiments that we're doing. C.K. Law has been a postdoc who's worked with me and with Joe Eberly, who's also contributed to some of this work. So the spirit of what I want to go through is a little bit more in kind of a review and preview style. And if you look at this outline and you think that I'm going to have to go at nearly the speed of light to cover all this material, you're probably right. But don't worry, I probably won't communicate very much information on the way. First of all, we've been doing work in cold collisions, and I just want to give you a sample of that to help convince you, amongst other things, that our program does have a very strong experimental side. The majority of what I'd like to talk about is in this area here, and that is, in a sense, to summarize some work that we've done, which has recently been published and was quite elegantly and flatteringly described in an article in Nature by Brett Esri and Chris Green. I'd like to tell you a little bit about some evaporation models we've been doing on two-species systems to start to address the question of whether we think we can produce Bose condensates of two distinct alkali atoms together. And then to talk a little bit about stability, phase diffusion, and if I can make it, to risk getting involved in this vortex discussion. Well, our work in two-species experiments started, three or four years ago, and it started with experiments in magneto-optical traps. So if you were to come in conceptually to the laboratory, you would find this kind of a situation, one of these chambers in which a bunch of atoms are collected and trapped, and instead of having one set of lasers that operates this trap, having two sets of lasers, basically each one addressing a different atomic species that's confined together in that magneto-optical trap. And what we set out to do in this work, because at that time Bose condensation hadn't been realized, was to look at lots of different quantum aspects of the interactions, collisions, diffusion, problems of this sort, in these atomic mixtures. And when we started that work, one of the sort of natural things to do is you form this trap in your laboratory, and you put species 1 into the trap and watch that little cloud develop and stabilize, and you put species 2 into this trap and you watch that cloud develop and stabilize, and you ask very simple questions like, are they interacting? A simple way to do that is you tune some parameters of the laser, maybe the laser intensity, and you look at the density of atoms in the trap. And this is the density of cesium atoms in a trap containing both cesium and sodium atoms. This is an optical trap now, so there's a lot of photons present. And the bottom line is, at the resolution of this data, nothing seems to have changed. Well, from one point of view, that's good because it means this trap is preparing two ultra-cold samples. The temperatures here, in the case of cesiums, are close to the Doppler temperature, 100 microkelvin kind of a number. For sodium, it's almost twice that. However, that's obviously not the whole story, or I probably wouldn't have said it quite that way. If we look at what sodium does in this trap with a mixture of sodium and cesium, we find out the story is quite different. The red plot is a plot of the density of atoms trapped in this little cloud as a function of the trapping laser intensity. And when we go to the mixture case, the bottom line is the number of trapped atoms in this magneto-optical trap, trapped sodium atoms, is greatly suppressed. So some way or other, these species are interacting in a way that preferentially depletes the sodium from the optical trap. Now, we've spent some time studying this and trying to understand exactly what goes on in that. I'll just give you a quick snapshot of how that thinking goes. This is my much tamer version of the really true interatomic potentials that, for example, Bill Swalley showed us earlier. But the key to understanding some of these losses, particularly in the heteronuclear traps, comes from these pictures. We imagine two atoms coming together on the ground state. Of course, this is where Bose condensation spends its time living and where the scattering lengths come from. But the bottom line is there's a very short-range interaction here, something like 1 over r to the sixth. When you have a homonuclear trap, identical atoms coming together, one of them in the excited state, you pick up this long-range resonant dipole term. In some sense, you can think of that as the exchange terms that come out of the fact that one excited, one ground state atom can flop that photon backwards and forwards and feel an attraction for each other. When we go to the doubly excited state, we come back to a shorter range to the interaction. And Bill Swelly told us, for example, amongst others, about the kinds of states that could be formed up here in these long-range potential wells. But in terms of forming a trap of these atoms and getting a good dense sample to start, for example, evaporative cooling, the kinds of things that can cause you troubles in the optical trap are that you can absorb a photon here at long range, and because it's long range, there could be some time of evolution for the center of mass of the two nuclei, of the two atoms, during which you move down this potential curve and, for example, decay. And when that happens, you pick up a certain amount of energy because this photon is not the same color as that photon, and that energy comes into kinetic energy and causes atoms to be ejected. All kinds of other interesting processes happen. You come down here and you come back out, shifting from one hyperfine level here to another, again picking up kinetic energy and getting trap loss to happen. And early in the study of cold collisions in these optical traps, the dominant strategy was simply to take a very phenomenological point of view, and that's a place we started some of our work, which is to just characterize some loading rate in a rate equation formalism. Here's a loading rate for atoms in, here's a collision rate that depends linearly on the density of trapped atoms. Those are collisions where a trapped atom is knocked out by some atom not participating in the trap. And the physics you're interested in are these two body terms in here. And you often get this kind of a set of parameters by fitting the loading or filling of your trap as a function of time. And we have done that for this case of sodium and cesium, as well as more recently, extensively for sodium and rubidium mixtures. And the kind of characteristic curves we get out look like this. This is the kind of stuff that was in PhysRev letters, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago in terms of magnitude optical trap cold collisions. Here for the cesium case, there's a very characteristic shape to this curve. It comes down and comes up, plotting the two-body rate as a function of intensity. And what's going on in here is at very low intensities, the trap depth is very shallow, and if there's a change in the hyperfine state, the ground state, that could be a large enough energy scale that it causes atoms to be lost from the trap. As the trapping intensity is turned up, the trap becomes deeper, and that rate decreases, but then begins to turn back up and increase again as you start to excite more atoms optically in the trap. Of course, in the case of the sodium, we see a big difference if we include a two-body term that crosses the two species, and it's that rate up there that's causing a large trap loss. Now, I haven't really said anything about the microscopics of what's producing that, and I don't really want to focus on that in this talk because the material I'd like to get to is the more directly linked to the subject of this meeting. But one of the origins of the difference is that when we start to look at pair interactions, not for the homonuclear case, but for the heteronuclear case, ground-ground, ground-excited potential, we don't have that long-range resonant dipole interaction. What we have is much more of a short-range, and that's because we have distinguishable atoms. So excitation can happen much closer into this core, and all of the interesting collisional physics that involve state changes and things as the atoms collide along this potential surface can, in some cases, have much higher probability of happening. If you excite up here and you're waiting for the atom to coast towards the other atom down that long potential, it has a huge chance of decaying first, whereas if you've got the short-range thing, it doesn't. And we've used that to interpret a lot of the differences in the cold collisions in this system. But a particularly interesting discovery that we made in the sodium and cesium atomic mixture case relates to the following piece of physics that is tied directly to the photoassociative processes that Bill Swelly discussed and that Randy mentioned, except this is a particular kind of a process that happens in sodium. Now, the level diagrams are getting more complicated, and I don't really want that to turn you off from this picture, but the key feature that I want you to think about for a moment is that there happens to be a coincidence in sodium by which you can absorb a photon from the trap, couple into one of these long-range states, absorb another photon, go into this doubly excited state, and that state lies near or above the bottom of the molecular ion potential. So there's a chance that you'll cross that barrier and produce a molecular ion. In essence, what happens is two excited atoms are together, and one of the electrons drops down in this quasi-molecule that's been formed, and the other electron is ejected out, kind of like an Auger process. Now, what is nice about this is it allows you to study all kinds of the features of the level structure in here, and eventually, if you're clever, to learn things about the S-wave scattering length down in here. But also, because it's a molecular ion, you can really tag what's going on. That collision byproduct is very, very detectable and can be isolated from all kinds of good things that might be going on and confusing your measurements. Now, here's the rate constant for that process. Again, it's just a phenomenological rate constant. It tells you something about the time rate of change of these products as a function of the number of atoms in your density of atoms in your trap. And perhaps you won't be surprised to find out that in this particular trap, if we take it and we add cesium to it, the rate of ion production goes up what's something like 3 orders of magnitude. And we spent some time trying to understand what the heck that was about. What we discovered by using a time-of-flight technique to basically measure the mass spectrum of things being produced that were charged from the trap, we discovered that we were producing not only Na2+ from this sodium-cesium mixture, but Cs+, Cs2+, but quite interestingly, we were building heteronuclear molecules, photo-associating heteronuclear molecules. And as we start to work on this, I think at this point most people recognize right away that one interest in those kinds of measurements is getting scattering lengths of sodium against cesium. So we've done a lot of spectroscopic work, and this is really just getting flashed up here to give you the sense that there are lots of interesting spectra come out. Here what's happening is you're tuning around the laser wavelength, so you're tuning through different bound levels in this coupling process. The black curves are the structures that you see for pure sodium. You see well-defined sharp resonances for bound-bound transitions, broad things for bound continuum transitions. When we put the cesium in, we get a huge broad line shape showing you really how fast that process is. Now, fortunately for us, or unfortunately for us, sodium and cesium are not the best candidates right now for doing double Bose condensates. I think it's well known that cesium is a problem child as it is. So if what we're hoping to do is to take this trap with two species and produce a two-species condensate, this is probably not a good place to start. A lot of interesting atomic and molecular physics, but not so good for BEC. So since then, we've constructed a sodium and rubidium trap, and that trap does not show any of these dramatic losses. And fortunately, we've now loaded those atoms from this mixture into a magnetic trap and are looking at the thermalization processes between those two species. Well, it's a slide that I love to show. It's a little bit old, but just about the time that the really remarkable announcements were coming out about the realization of Bose condensation, this was 1995, right? I got this advertisement from some company trying to get me to buy some stuff, and it said on the bottom of it, Nick Bigelow, don't get left in the dust. And of course, this was their catalog. But I saw this and was thinking, okay, here's BEC, and there's sodium rubidium marching off into the future. So we began to work very vigorously on producing a double Bose condensate. And as we built and constructed apparatus, we couldn't help ourselves but also get involved in doing theoretical work. So the ideas that are well established are that what becomes of interest, of course, when you have these two interpenetrating quantum fluids, is that you get new features. You get two amplitudes and two quantum phases. And the question is how that coupled system behaves. And we've heard some very nice work on that, particularly in the two spin states case. There are some interesting possibilities for vortices, and the kind that we're focusing on is sodium and rubidium. And it's this set of questions down here that we've been spending a lot of our time theoretically thinking about. The place we started was the place many people who were looking at this from the theoretical side, particularly from the atomic physics quantum optics community, started, which was to start looking at solutions of the Gross-Piderewski equation. And the feature that comes out, of course, is that we've got a new scattering length, so we get two terms that couple the two nonlinear Schrodinger Hamiltonians together. And solving even one of these is a messy business, and when we first started to work on this problem, the most common approximation used to even solve the single species case was the Thomas Fermi approximation, to neglect the kinetic energy terms. And we had some concern about the validity of this. In fact, over time, we've had that concern smoothed out quite a bit. But the thinking was that when you have two coupled species, the overlaps are going to be where a lot of the interesting action may happen, then the Thomas Fermi approximation isn't so hot at treating those overlaps. So we developed a numerical technique, and as you'll find out, for various reasons, solving matrix problems are something that my students and I are extremely comfortable at attacking. So many of the problems that I'm going to tell you about involve taking one of these systems and somehow reducing the physics that we're trying to address into a matrix problem, which we can then solve numerically. The way we solved this system was to basically take and discretize space in some trapped volume and to solve it using a finite element method. In essence, what we do is we assume two trial wave functions, we discretize space and diagonalize the Hamiltonians for these wave functions, iterating this whole process in a self-consistent way to find ground states or, as I'll point out to you, metastable states. Now, I will be probably terribly neglectful of citing many of the important pieces of work that have come out related to all the different things I'll tell you about. The ones that I think stand out most clearly for me are the paper by Ho and Shinoy that came out about the time we were first starting to think about this work, and they solved these coupled equations in the Thomas Fermi approximation. Brett Esri at Gila worked on this. Pierre Meister worked on it sometime back in the absence of potential, and of course we know about the beautiful experiments now at Gila and at MIT as well. And probably one of the most interesting starting features that came out of the double condensate was this concept of having phase separation. In essence, if I plot here the magnitude of the macroscopic wave function as a function of, say, radial coordinate outward in a spherically symmetric trap, depending on this interspecies scattering length parameter, I can have overlapping or non-overlapping ground states. And of course, just to point out the difference in the amplitude here is because I need an R-squared scaling to get the true number of atoms correctly. But that's a very interesting effect, and of course, since I don't have a Bose condensate that does this, the best we can do is make pictures that look like we do. And here's a cross-section of one of these spherically symmetric trapped clouds. Of course, you can see that the student who's working on this somehow missed it because that's the color of sodium, if you've ever seen a sodium trap. But the idea basically is that the system minimizes its energy by having one of the condensates at the center of the other. And how it minimizes its energy depends on that number there, as well as the particle number. And there is a kind of an intuitive way to think about that, which isn't really quite correct, but it's quite useful. Here I plot, for example, the density distribution. This is psi 2 squared as a function of radial coordinate for different N1s. Okay? And N1 in this case is the species in the rubidium sodium mixture that sits at the center of this trap. Now I'm treating the traps as spherically symmetric and no gravity, so they are overlapping unless there's a quantum repulsion effect. And one of the ways you can understand what goes on here, we're increasing the number of atoms in the core, which pushes the shell outwards. Intuitively, you can think of this Hamiltonian for that outside wave function and kind of regroup it and think of the potential term as including the cross-species interaction. So when I have this core, instead of having the simple parabolic potential, the core effectively provides a repulsive potential so that the outer condensate fills in space around it. So of course, it's not quite correct because we have to solve these coupled equations self-consistently, but it does give you some picture as to how it happens. And you can see the degree of overlap between the two condensate wave functions decreases as you boost up the quantity of stuff in the center and the outside shell gets pushed further and further out. Now, it's a quick stop by on the way because I did mention it. We were able to solve this because of our numerical approach, including all of the terms in the Hamiltonian without making the Thomas Fermi approximation. These solid line curves are the curves made with the Thomas Fermi. In fact, these curves are identical to ones that Jason Ho has published. And we compared our results numerically to that, and you see that, in fact, it works bloody well, except right here near the edges and, of course, near the overlap regions. So the Thomas Fermi approximation is actually pretty good in getting the global shapes correct, but if you want quantitative detail, it's not so good. And a point that I think is worth emphasizing is that this phase separation segregation that happens in the ground states depends not only on the scattering length, but depends on the number of particles. It depends on the mean field energy. so that in fact some of the data that was shown from JILA, as well as data that may come from MIT, you can imagine that there's truly a multidimensional phase space in which this system does various kinds of things. And basically what I'm showing you is that dependence changing particle numbers going from well overlapping condensates to places where you have cores and outside shells. Well, en route, of course, we had to put gravity in, and this was at the time when JILA was first doing their works and show how the condensate shapes change, overlap in the middle region. But the place that we wanted to move a little bit more forward on was to think about some of the consequences of this piece in the center being surrounded by a shell. So we began to focus for a period on the case where the system was phase segregated. And one interesting feature that came out is now I'm plotting sort of the reciprocal version of that same plot I showed you before for the outer species, but now here's the inner species as a function of radial coordinate, where I'm building up the outer shell density. As I put more and more particles in the outer shell, no surprise, the inner material gets compressed in here, and I can in fact calculate the peak density at the core. And what I see is that the core is actually compressed by the outer shell. It literally squeezes in on the outer shell. Now, that could be a real feature in terms of getting a high-density condensate in the center. Of course, it could be problematic if you have relaxation problems. But that's one of the interesting features that comes out of this separation, is that there's an effective pressure from the outside material towards the inside. Well, a natural thing for us to turn our attention to, please.
The value of 3.6, it's a known...
No. At this time, let me answer your question with more than just the answer. We are now doing experiments in sodium rubinium and hope to have that measured by photoassociative spectroscopy, if not by the collisional rates in the magnetic trap. This number was simply a mean between sort of nominally accepted values for the two species. So it was just a guess. But the key point is that this compression effect will happen if I shift this number around over certain ranges, may take different outside particle numbers, but the generic qualitative behavior will still be preserved.
I'm surprised that it's like such a large, because there is no resonance just now between particles.
And I'll come to that point in a minute, because there's some interesting aspects of that. As one might guess, following the chronology of the field, the thing we began to look at next were the excitation frequencies of the double Bose condensate. And the approach we took is very similar to the one, for example, it's the Bogu-Yubov approach described by Ruppert et al. So we take the Bogu-Yubov approximation, we then recast the problem in terms of an eigenvalue problem in which this matrix M depends on the individual Hamiltonians, the wave functions, the interaction strengths, and this matrix eta here has the following diagonal form. And then we use a finite difference approximation to solve this again. Same trick as always, we like matrix problems, and to treat this as a generalized eigenvalue problem. And that allows us to compute the excitation frequencies. Again, I want to stress that the feature is we could do this in the full nonlinear Gross-Prodiev equation. And we began our attention in looking at this by focusing on the case where we have overlapping condensates. So we choose parameters that we know give us overlapping condensates. And again, for simplicity, we look at spherically symmetric traps in the data I'm going to show you, the calculations I'm going to show you. And we have done this for non-spherically symmetric traps as well. Here's an example of some of the kinds of spectra you see, again, because we don't know this scattering length. I'm going to be plotting a lot of things as a function of the cross-species scattering length. The excitation frequency in the units of twice the trap frequency. And here we're looking at the n equals 0 and 1 modes and the first L mode. Now, because this is a spherically symmetric system, we have these two quantum numbers that float around. And it's probably not surprising as you think about this, for negative scattering length, that is to say a cross-species net attractive interaction, the frequencies shift upwards of the excitation modes. The system effectively becomes stiffer due to the attraction between the two. And of course, if I go to repulsive interactions, by that same argument, the system and the modes become softer and their frequencies go down. And what I want to draw your attention to, because I'll come back to this point, is that down here, this frequency actually goes to zero, and if I push my calculations, what I find is that I get imaginary frequencies beyond this point, and this tells me something about the stability of that state against excitations. We can look at the similar kinds of responses, and I couldn't help but put this title on because somebody referred to that earlier this semester, essentially the experiments of shaking the trap, as somebody I think put it, or wiggling the trap. Here are these first three isotropic breathing modes. So these are just the n equals 0, 1, 2 modes. And I see an interesting feature. The difference between the triangles and the stars here, I'll tell you about in a minute. It tells you about whether these modes, these breathing modes, are symmetric or antisymmetric. That is to say, I have species 1's cloud that can go in phase with species 2 or can go out of phase. One can be compressing while the other is expanding. And what I see here is that for negative interactions, the lowest lying mode will turn out to be, this is attractive interactions, will turn out to be the out of phase mode because the time averaged overlap between the two species is maximized that way. And being attractive, that lowers their energy. When I shift to positive scattering length, the lowest lying mode is the anti-symmetric mode in which the atoms can spend more times away from each other. And to really get an understanding of how that was at a pictorial level, what we did is set out to solve this problem not by using a Bogdanov approximation and calculating the frequencies in that fashion, but instead by integrating the coupled nonlinear Schrodinger equations. And the kind of behavior we see when we do this direct integration using, for the experts in the audience, a Crank-Nicholson method, are displayed in the following pictures. Here we are with one excitation frequency, which turns out to be far from any of the normal modes of the low-lying normal modes of the system. And we see some response, but basically the density at the center of the trap of sodium and rubidium do nothing very clear. We see a pair of structures, the two little peaks here are the driving frequency. But when we start to come closer to resonance down here, to that L equals 1 mode, for example, we see two clear kinds of responses, one in which the modes are oscillating opposite to each other, so here's a density minimum when there's a density maximum, and symmetric modes. And because, of course, these are nonlinear equations, it's probably not surprising when I do the Fourier spectrum of that response, I see that I pick up harmonics of the driving frequency. Now, I just have to keep up with the Joneses here a little bit, and if Yvonne Castan doesn't know what that means, he will in a second. The presentation from Gilla of this experiment in which a pi pulse is applied and the scattering length is suddenly changed, I couldn't resist but calling up Rochester and getting somebody to take this direct integral method, which was asked about during the end of Carl's talk, and model the Gilla experiment. Now, here it's not quite a model because this is a spherically symmetric integrator, but here we've integrated the peak density as a function of time for the case where you suddenly change the scattering length. And it's probably not surprising. You see just what you would expect. The wave function breathes in and out in response to that. So this was calculated, I'm sorry, not yesterday, but 2 days ago, and gotten to me by downloading it from the web. One of the interesting aspects of this technique that we've developed of finding the ground states for these coupled nonlinear equations is that we can find not only true ground states, but metastable ground states. And there is some question as to what the metastable ground states and ground states are. But here's an example of one particular metastable state that we found we could create. The ground state that I've described to you at the beginning of my talk, or the BEC part of the talk, had the rubidium in the core and the sodium around the outside. What I can do is I can construct a wave, trial wave function at the start of my minimization, my solution series, in which I exchange the place of these two species. And I can find that the system will converge to stable states in which the rubidium forms the shell on the outside of the sodium. And one of the ways we can see that is that we can then take our integrator and perturb the system and watch it respond. If we take the system in this more global ground state in which the sodium is the outside shell, and we begin to perturb it, we find that the rubidium responds, oscillates. The sodium responds if I blow this up and oscillates, but nothing dramatic happens. This is the density at the center of the trap as a function of time while I'm jiggling the trap. Small amplitude, but I can put an arbitrary amplitude in here. In fact, what I'm doing as a function of time here is I'm very slowly increasing the amplitude. What I find is that at very small amplitudes, there's a very tiny response. The outside shell wiggles. The inside shell wiggles just a little bit. But as the amplitude begins to pick up, very suddenly, the two exchange places. It's a metastable state, so it's no surprise that I begin to get it to modulate quickly enough the core would rather have the rubidium in it and the sodium on the outside, so the two exchange their states. This was actually an idea that came out of the discussion with Charles Clark, so I'd like to point that out. And it is a feature of this particular approach that we can find trial wave function metastable solutions out of it rather than seeking true ground states.
What is the explanation? Maybe what is the explanation that
Well, if I think of what the mean field energy is doing as a function of time, it relates to the overlap between the two species, amongst other things. As they begin to breathe more and more strongly, that overlap changes quite a lot. And I reach a point at which the energies are such that the system perhaps can tunnel through a barrier. The exact mechanism by which I get from this state back to this state, this model doesn't really tell me. So it's a very interesting question, and I don't know quite the answer to it. Please tell me. I beg your pardon?
Did you put any noise into the calculation?
In what sense? This is a mean field thing, so we have not put fluctuations in. No. But we've looked at that. This is just driving the trap.
But this amplitude that you have very, very large suddenly.
Yes.
Depends on the amplitude which you are vibrating with your...
Very much so. Very much so. That's right. That's right. When you're down here, of course, this stuff is around the outside. It's not feeling the stimulation so much. And when it swaps places, it feels a much stronger excitation. But to give you an intuitive explanation for that at the moment, it's going to have to see more work. I beg your pardon? Yes? It's another technique, and in the brief time that I spoke to Chris Green, who has done some work on that approach, the answer was no. That's right. But I shouldn't answer that in a general way because I myself haven't spent much time trying that approach. A good question to ask at this point, for example, is, well, that seems like a great idea, but can you build it? Can you make it in the laboratory? And as a sideline, we began to work on an algorithm which has been applied to condensate formation developed by Bird, but used by Armando and Wu and Chris Foote and so forth. It's basically to take a collection of atoms, divide them up into little cells, let each cell undergo some collisions with the bosonic enhancement factor, and iterate the momentum distribution of that sample. You can put evaporative cooling in here, and you can decide whether the atoms are getting kicked beyond the range of your scalpel and so forth, but you can use this to model some of the kinetics of the cooling process. And we did this with the two-species system. Of course, if you don't put any evaporation in, what you very quickly find is you put the two species together and you give them some time. Here you put them in at their individual Doppler temperatures, and of course they come to thermal equilibrium. But if you begin to take that system and apply evaporative cooling to it, what you find is that, sure enough, evaporative cooling works in the model. And this is very similar to a model that was used by Jean Dalibard as well to look at some of the evaporation kinetics, I believe. And we see that as we evaporate, no surprise, we can individually evaporate each of the atoms. They cool down. They cross their respective systems. And if we could only make it up here, I would be jumping up and down and telling you more about it. But an interesting question to ask is, how did that happen in time? And what's interesting is that using this modeling technique, we find that if we start out with the sodium and rubidium at kinds of densities that people have started their experiments so far, we find that, in fact, the sodium condenses before the rubidium. So if we're so lucky as to have that actually happen, what we will do is we will build that metastable state, that the sodium will condense first, forming its cloud at the center, and the rubidium will condense later. But to add an interesting thing, one of the things you can do with this kind of a calculation, and I don't claim this has got a profound consequence, but it's fun to show you, is I can go to this nice paper here by these guys, Hewlett being one of them, and I can look at this way they've modeled some of the decay rate for this instability process in the negative scattering length case. And from this, we can extract a rate which we can put into our model and say, well, what if we had a negative scattering length system? What would the difference be in the way the condensate forms if I allow a decay rate out of the condensate as well as a growth rate into it from the kinetics? And it's probably not a surprise that if we do this for Now, the mistake here is these are sodium atoms with positive and negative scattering length, not lithiums. Sodium, the condensate grows, continues to grow, and up here we start to see it limited by how the evaporation process is scooping atoms in from the starting number we had. And of course, no surprise, if we take this phenomenon called loading or leaking rate, we put it in, the system comes up and saturates. Just this morning, my email message came through and said if we put that rate in, it saturates up here at about 1600 instead, if we do the numbers correct for lithium. So this model is actually quite a fun way to look at some of the kinetics, but it is really not a very rigorous model. Now I'd like to shift gears a little bit and answer, or begin to answer, one of the questions that Yuri was getting at. We began to think early on about issues of stability. And in a sense, the question we were asking was, is there a parameter for a two-species system which plays the role of a single scattering length in determining the stability of the condensate? The way we approached that was to reach back a little bit further and go to a fully second quantized Hamiltonian and to ask ourselves what the fluctuations do to the energy. If we can identify a parameter such that fluctuations cause the energy to increase, the system will be defined as not being stable. If we can find a parameter which has a different character and causes fluctuations to have the energy increase, we'll define the system as stable. And the approach we'll do to that to start to put the fluctuations in is a very familiar approach to most people here. And that is to linearize that grand canonical Hamiltonian by taking the mean field solutions and putting a fluctuation term on top of them. Again, if we do that, we can cast this problem, same old tricks again, as a matrix problem in which we've got these Vs representing by these field operators, and this matrix here being the key determinant in what K will do is dependent on what the fluctuations are like. And it turns out that we can take that matrix and we can give it a unitary transformation and make it semi-diagonal. And when we do that, we learn something. This little piece up here in the left-hand corner is just the Hamiltonians for the bare system, so that will always be semi-positive. This component down here has a busy structure to it, but it can admit negative eigenvalues. And if it's got a negative eigenvalue, there can be a term for which the fluctuations will cause the energy to decrease, and that's what we're going to call an unstable case. So the system is, the way we're attacking this is really a very simple kind of a picture once we've written down that fancy Hamiltonian and basically saying what is the curvature of the energy surface locally. We have identified that if the smallest eigenvalue of that matrix M, if it's positive, that curvature is positive and the system is stable to fluctuations. Because if it's negative, the system has a negative curvature and it's unstable. So this lowest eigenvalue of that matrix M, that one single parameter, has kind of the role of a single scattering length. Now, we do have to calculate that beast numerically, at least in the approaches we're taking. And what's interesting, here I'm again in sodium-rubidium system using sodium and rubidium more or less scattering lengths. That red line is that eigenvalue. What was interesting to us is that we can have a stable condensate, a condensate in which the two species are overlapping, over both positive and negative cross-species scattering lengths. Interesting question is what happens out here and what happens out here? And I'll tell you in a minute about those ends. The place that we began to look at what that meant is to look at a particular kind of a fluctuation, and the fluctuation we're thinking at here now is particle numbers. Now, if we look at the change in energy when we admit a certain fluctuation in particle numbers, we can rewrite that exchange, that energy difference term in the following form, where these gammas turn out to be the one over the masses are curvatures. And these terms here are very much like you would see it for a single species case. The L's and so forth that we see show the same tricks before, and the important feature is that L that shows up in this particular treatment is exactly the same L that I showed you before. Okay. So if I look at the change in the energy of the system and contrast what I just wrote down on the one species case and the two species case, I can see they have a similar form. In the single species case with repulsive interactions, this curvature or like 1 over mass term in the energy when I admit a density fluctuation gives me a positive change, stable system. This is the unstable case. When I go to the two species, I can recast this problem to have the following two forms. And what's interesting about it is these alphas and betas are labeling some mixture of terms, not individual species. So we began to realize that one of the ways to look at this problem was not in terms of the individual species, but some sort of weighted mixture of them, some sort of quasi-species, reminiscent of dress states, if you will, in quantum optics. So what's going on in this case here for these numbers we've picked, here's that eigenvalue again. It goes negative over here. Gamma A is the one of the two gammas that goes negative in those two regions. Now, if we look at this...
What is the product of A1 and A2?
A...
The two individual...
18.
So the square root is 4 and a bit, which is...
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Exactly. When this gamma here goes negative, that's what causes the energy to decrease when you admit these fluctuations in N1 and N2. And what's interesting is if we look on the left-hand side, for negative scattering length, when the system becomes unstable here, and we find out what that theta is in the way I've written it down that rotation angle, theta is pi over 4, and over here it's negative pi over 4. So an interesting thing is happening. When a fluctuation is admitted, and I write down this energy difference function here, okay, on one side I get cosine, a positive number, I get a positive number. What happens is the system can decrease its energy by increasing the difference, a weighted difference in the two numbers of atoms in the condensate. If I go to the positive scattering length instability side, turns out it's minus pi over 4, this term allows the system to decrease its energy by increasing the sum of the two.
Can I ask you, I don't understand if you have the positive A1, 2, why gamma A started to be negative? It's not gamma already A, something mixture already.
That's right. It's not gamma A, though.
No,
I'm very carefully.
It became negative just gamma.
This is not species A or species B. These are these labels of these quasi-species, these mixtures of the two. Okay?
So that means gamma A is just here? It's like meaningless, that in this case...
I take this Hamiltonian. What I've done is I've tried to rotate the Hamiltonian to find a basis to look at it in which I can look at the problem very much in the way I look at a single species condensate. In particular, for example, I can take the two species Hamiltonian and I can write it in a form where I identify two terms that look just like the zero modes of the single species condensate. Okay? And those two P alphas and P betas that represent these individual quasi species commute. So I've decoupled the system somehow by treating it as these two weighted mixtures, one of which has a plus and another one has a minus sign in the way I weight them.
I mean, that's basically just the eigenvalues of the matrix which just has the
same. Yes, of course. But
that's right.
Already
not
connected this one type of dependence.
I've stopped looking at it from the point of view of condensate A and condensate B. I'm looking at a space in which I've rotated my
that's
basis.
That's why now A is not one of the condensates.
That's right. That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Exactly. And what's curious about that is I can start to have a physical picture with which I can look at it. Yeah, I know, Randy, I'm running out of time, but I've been asked questions. Here's this energy surface as a function of particle number. Okay? What it's telling me is that that energy surface that may be, say, a trough, okay, as I change particle number, it's a trough, but the axis, the natural axes of that trough are not aligned along the particle axes N1 and N2, but at some angle. By rewriting the Hamiltonians that I have done, what I've done is I've rotated my frame of reference, my coordinate system, so that I'm now along the trough axes here. Okay? Well, here's the interpretation I give. In one case, if I go to very strong negative interspecies scattering lengths, I think I know what's going to happen. the system's going to collapse due to an attractive instability. When I go over to the other side of this stability plot here, something very different happens. Over here, the system separates because I was assuming in this region I had completely overlapping condensates. The instability is, for a very strong positive scattering length, that the two condensates would rather separate into two separate condensates. So what I've done is the system will grow by minimizing the difference between the two in the overlap. It's not a surprise in a sense. Okay, the phase fluctuations have an interesting consequence, but because time is rapidly disappearing, I won't mention it. I'll cut it out. Phase fluctuations tell me about how the shape of that energy surface is again. The phase fluctuations tell me how the system responds to fluctuations in particle number, because quantum mechanically, particle number and phase are intimately related. I can have situations in which that trough is actually completely flat. And one of the linear combinations of these two species actually exhibits no phase diffusion between the two of them. That's an interesting point because we were asking earlier in this meeting how Carl Wieman should think about the experiment in which, in rubidium, he sees surprisingly small phase fluctuations. Well, why am I cutting that out? Partially because I'm out of time, but also because I'd like to tell you a little bit about this vortex problem, since it seems to be increasingly of interest to the community. Let's go back to those excitations that I showed you, the excitation spectra that I showed you. I showed you that in one of those excitation spectra, for a certain combination of particle number and scattering length, when I solve for the excitation frequencies in the Bogoliubov approximation, I get frequencies that go to zero and then become imaginary. Imaginary frequencies represent instabilities. They do even outside of the Bogoliubov approximation when we solve the problem. So what we began to look at was, what's the stability behavior of a vortex state? In particular, if we write down, and I don't want to confuse the discussion talking about vortices in the helium sense. If I write down a wave function which has a finite M or L here, and I'll call that a vortex state, I want to look at the excitation spectra of that state that I found to satisfy the coupled Gross-Podiesky equations, and ask whether the excitation frequencies are purely real. If they're purely real, those excitations are stable. If they're imaginary, those excitations are not stable. So what we've done is to do exactly that, and following the paper, the work that was done by, amongst others, Mark Edwards and co-workers, we find that these U's and V's that show up in the Bogoliubov treatment pick up little M's or L's that have U and V subscripts on them. And we find that there are a whole family of instabilities that can be observed. And in particular case that I want to show you the stability diagram of here, we're thinking of a state M equals 2, and we're plotting the imaginary part of the excitation frequency as a function of this mean field strength here. What we see is that there are regions in mean field strength or particle number and scattering length product in which there is no imaginary part. So that excitation frequency, that excitation there is completely stable. But that there are definite regions in here where we have a large imaginary part. In fact, the inverse of that imaginary part tells us of the lifetime of that particular excitation if I were to try to form it. Now, there's an interesting feature that showed up in the numerics as a starting point. The numerics showed that the only cases where we ever saw imaginary frequency components showing up in the excitation spectrum happened to satisfy the case where the mu here and the mv here were equal to 2 times m, the initial angular momentum of the trial state. By the way, an interesting feature is for m equals 1 here, we never found under any conditions imaginary excitation frequencies, suggesting that that state is ultimately stable. We then went to a second quantized Hamiltonian, looked in the interaction picture, and the interpretation here began to be fairly clear. The only time that we could scatter particles from, say, the m equals 2 vortical state into other states and get imaginary frequencies were when, of course, angular momentum was conserved. So here's two particles in n equals 2 producing one excitation at m equals 0 and one excitation at m equals 4 conserving angular momentum. Now that was clear from simply looking at the interaction Hamiltonian. Why do we get these islands in this picture? Well, again, we have to conserve energy as well. There will only be certain mean field energy combinations in which taking two particles out of the L equals 2 or M equals 2 vortical state into these other pair of states can conserve momentum and energy at the same time. And that's a qualitative reason is why we get these islands here. Of course, we can look at more complicated situations. An L equals 3 or M equals 3 vortex can go to a 0 and 6, two particles. One goes down, one goes up. Or a 1 and 5. And then we see an increasing number of different instability regions. So basically what can happen is if the system is in here and I produce an excitation, it can start scattering particles off into these other possible vortical states. The way we should perhaps think about this, at least in this model, is that if I create a high L or high M vortical state, it will begin to shed vortices or excitations to all other angular momenta, eventually percolating down to the ground or first excited first vortical state, and there it will remain stable. And as with other people, I'm not completely at home with all the aspects of the Rockshar work, but one aspect that does distinguish our calculation from his is that what we're looking here is we don't have to evoke the presence of background non-condensed atoms to participate and conserve angular momentum. Angular momentum is being conserved in this calculation. It's simply being conserved by shedding vortices of other angular momenta. Okay, so what we're really looking at is the stability of the against disintegration of the vortex into all kinds of other vortices, ultimately down to the ground state. None of this happens without people. There's Vitek and Jim, who did the sodium-cesium work. There's Anato and Paul, who have really put together the sodium-rubidium experiment. Here's where BEC happens in our lab. I'm afraid to say right now it happens inside that machine. That's Han, who made it happen. And C.K. Law, I don't have a picture of, and I don't dare draw a picture of Joe Everly. He looks like that. And, of course, somebody has to pay for it. And in order of appearance, these are the people that paid for it. Thanks for your attention.
Now I see why you didn't have a title to your talk. You had three talks.
That's right. It's a movie.
Any questions?
Yeah. Comment. When Shana and I did our work, we focused on the case where the G12 is greater than the geometric mean of G11, G12, because we know that there's something funny happening here in the other case. And recently, about a week ago, I received some news from a new group from Delaware. They have done a Monte Carlo calculation for the other case, and what they have found, which I think is very interesting, is that the system does separate in a long cylindrical symmetric fashion. And so what happened is that in that case, that the two condensates, instead of separating like this, separating like sort of sideways, it creates rotational symmetry. I think probably what happened is that in a top trap, because the top trap is rather fat, so then the surface energy is minimized when you separate it this way. On the other hand, if you have go into a more yawky set of trap and you have a situation of phase separation, then one might be able to separate in a cylindrical symmetric fashion to separate in a lead direction.
Yes.
And I believe in that case that one might even, there's a tendency, great tendency of phase separation, but one might still be able to get a fairly large region of overlap. So I think it would be interesting to study, for example, if you change the aspect ratio of the trap to see whether when it was phase separate like this or when it was phase separate like that.
In addition, this is for the record, there was a paper that I saw from somebody in Stenholm. And I hope it's not somebody in this audience, and I've forgotten their name. I believe it was that group, and they had claimed that, again, by solving the Gross-Podievsky, not doing a Monte Carlo, that there was, in fact, a lower-lying ground state that was phase-separated that was a broken symmetry in the sense that it had the two condensates physically separated, even though in their calculation everything was spherically symmetric. Now, what had surprised me a little bit, or what left me feeling slightly cautious, is that the energy difference between those two states was, you know, 5 decimal points in. And I worry about my calculations at the first decimal point, so I'm always slightly cautious. But it was described in a previous work that there might be some spontaneous symmetry breaking in the phase separation.
Any others? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next talk is by Mariana Hubiers from the University of Utrecht. Mariana, in your pocket.